Otto Hammerschmidt was not the smoothest flyer in the world, Paul Rubinstein decided, but seemed more than adequate to the task at hand. And the periodic sounds he heard from Natalia were like those of a restless sleeper, not displeasure with the ride. Natalia's head lay across Annie's lap over a blanket. Periodically, spittle dribbled from Natalia's partially open mouth, and Paul Rubinstein turned his head as Annie cleaned it away. That Natalia had come to this, he shivered. Was this, perhaps, in store for them all? The pressure causing them to snap, to break? The strain of it was evident in John Rourke's ordinarily calm face, the corners of John's mouth drawn down low, his cheeks deeply seamed, the brow beneath his high forehead drawn together and down, the eyebrows arched as he alternately looked at Natalia, then looked away, a look of powerlessness in his eyes that Paul Rubinstein had never seen there before. Suddenly, Paul was consumed with a desire that he knew was insane, to take Annie away from all of this, find somewhere on Earth where there was peace, and just live his life there with her, raise children. He closed his eyes for an instant, and when he opened them, Annie was looking at him, love in her eyes for him. Had she read his thoughts? Perhaps she had. He smiled at her.
We are nearing the landing zone!
Implicit in his words, though unstated, was the admonition to be ready for a quick jump-off so Hammerschmidt could get airborne again and take the liberated Soviet gunship out without being seen by either of the combatant forces. Paul glanced forward when Hammerschmidt called to them, and now he looked back toward where Annie still cradled Natalia in her lap. John bent over Annie, kissed his daughter's forehead, then knelt beside the two women. John's right hand gently, tentatively touching Natalia's cheek. Then John bent over her troubled face, touched his lips to her cheek, then stood, walking to the fuselage door, bracing himself there, ready. For what? Paul Rubinstein wondered. He dismissed the thoughts of what lay ahead of them, stood, making a last check of his gear. Then, holding to the rope guide stretching back along the length of the fuselage, he went to Annie, knelt beside her, took her face in his hands, and kissed her once.
Come back to me.
I will.
He hoped he wasn't lying.
Touchdown in 60 seconds.
Paul looked at his wife, then at Natalia, then once again at Annie.
I will.
Paul stood, moved back up the fuselage, and joined John beside the door. The helicopter started to settle, lurching slightly in the crosswinds from the heightening snowstorm. John wrenched the door back. The wind of their slipstream and the storm itself seemed to be sucked into the gunship as though filling a vacuum, and Paul Rubinstein fell back against it slightly, clawing his hood into position. The gunship landed and Paul looked back once, Annie still protecting Natalia, huddled near the lashed-in-place German specials, a smile on her lips, her eyes sad. Then Paul turned and jumped after John Rourke. The snow so heavy now it was like a wash of tiny needles of ice against his face. He hit the ground, not too hard, John almost lost already in the swirling whiteness of the downdraft. He was up, moving, following John Rourke as he had followed him for 5 centuries, and knew he would follow him until the day he died. A smile made his chill-numbed face feel alive for a moment. Heroes and sidekicks. John Rourke was the hero. Paul Rubinstein had once described himself as John's faithful Jewish companion.
Storylines never change in the life of a sidekick.
Michael Rourke elected to be first through the chimney, delegating Han Lu Chen to be last, since Prokopyev, with his injuries, might be more prone to difficulty. If he fell, he would need someone roped to him from above. As he moved down, Michael looked up. Maria Leuden scrambled after him, movement through the chimney, an arrhythmic combination of climbing, careful walking, and occasional crawling. The chimney was comparable to a narrowly winding stairwell, but irregular, treacherous, and, as the rock surface made it appear, a freak of nature rather than a contrivance of man. No map, no layout, however rudimentary, existed of the chimney, and as they moved ever deeper, there was no sense of where they were, how far they had come, how much of the journey remained. As Michael looked below him and moved on, he saw the chimney abruptly twist right. There was no real concept of north or south here without consulting a compass, and with no idea of the composition of the rock, a compass might prove useless anyway. The chimney seemed to twist into a low-ceilinged shelf. Michael reached the shelf, then reached up to aid Maria Leuden in her descent. She was in his arms the next instant, and her arms encircled his neck.
I love you.
Michael kissed her quickly, then moved her aside farther along the shelf, helping Prokopyev down, too.
I do not wish to be kissed.
Michael shook his head and smiled, feeling his cheeks slightly flushed.
I hadn't been planning on it, Vasily. No offense.
The Russian clapped him on the back and limped off to join Maria Lloyden. Han came down next.
Don't worry, I wasn't planning on it.
The Chinese intelligence agent looked at him uncomprehendingly. Michael took the German anglehead flashlight from where he had clipped it to the front of his parka and used the light to explore the shelf. Maria stood just ahead of him.
I think you should take a look at this, Michael.
Michael moved beside her.
I am glad you only kissed me.
I only meant to kiss you.
He then drew her against him and kissed her hair. He slid past her then.
What was it you saw that you wanted?
Directly ahead of him, through a niche in the wall, was a door. It appeared to be water and airtight, like a submarine door. It seemed to open and close by means of a locking wheel.
Get Vasily and Han.
Michael used the flashlight as he dropped into a crouch beside the locking mechanism, examining it to determine its age. It looked to be a familiar design, and the metal's integrity indicated it was either relatively new or exceptionally well made. There was tarnish in evidence, but it rubbed off to a dully gleaming brush finish under the pressure of his glove. Some sort of high-quality stainless steel with extreme surface hardness of perhaps a titanium alloy. The tarnish and the dust layer over it could have been the patina of centuries, decades, or months. Maria dropped to her knees beside him.
What do you think? How old?
They could not fabricate such metal as this now. It is why they use the old weapons or copies of them.
As Michael looked over his shoulder toward Han, the Chinese hefted his own ancient Glock pistol.
A door such as this would be impossible for them to manufacture. This door was made before the Dragon Wind, Michael.
Dragon Wind.
It was the Chinese term for the great conflagration, the fires that consumed the sky and nearly consumed all life on Earth.
Could this be an access chamber into the missile silos?
I think it could.
It might well be fitted with an alarm.
5 centuries old?
He is right. It wouldn't function anymore, would it, Michael?
Let's find out.
Michael curled his fingers over the wheel. He tried turning it, realized then that not only dust and tarnish had collected over the 5 centuries since its installation, but corrosion as well, despite the gleaming quality of the metal. He gripped it more tightly. Prokopyev threw his left hand to it. Han Lu Chen reached across Michael's bending back to grab hold of it. Maria's comparatively tiny hands took hold of the wheel as well.
Together. That sound could wake the dead.
And once awakened, who knew what might be behind the door? The valley that spread before them and fronted the second Chinese city could have been a biblical prophet's nightmare of Armageddon. Armageddon, perhaps, but not a nightmare, John Thomas Rourke knew, because it was real. Had the lucky ones indeed been those who died on the night of the war? And if that was World War III, rather than World War Last, then was he witnessing the beginnings of World War IV? He remembered history classes he took while completing the first 4 years of his university training. It was possible to trace World War II's beginning all the way back to the Franco-Prussian War, the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, back to Theodore Roosevelt's heavy-handed mediation of the settlement between the warring powers in the Russo-Japanese War. History was an interlocking grid of wars, separated only by brief respites during which the antagonists realigned and rearmed. Was the 5 centuries of the sleep merely this?
What are you thinking?
John Rourke looked away from the valley where Soviet ground forces and Second City Chinese forces battled to the death, where black Soviet gunships skimmed over the living and all living vanished in their wake.
But nothing has changed. It's time we were going.
Rourke moved back from the rocky overlook, the first few yards on knees and elbows until it was safe to stand and there was no risk of silhouetting himself against the gray sky. The threat of discovery from aerial observation was real. The two friends moved along the rocky rim of the valley, ever nearer the mountain that was the heart of the second Chinese city, where his son and the others went. At any moment, if Maria Lloyden's educated guessing proved correct, a missile might be launched, or the very mountain itself might explode as one or several nuclear warheads detonated within it. If the scientists were correct, the already fragile atmosphere, not yet recovered from the fires that nearly burned it away entirely 5 centuries before, would be dealt the death blow. Without planetary engineering techniques, not within the technical grasp of a mankind that for 5 centuries devoted all effort merely to survival, life on the surface of the Earth would simply end. The species Homo sapiens would have removed itself from the memory of the universe. Perhaps, if other life existed elsewhere, one of the Voyager-era robot probes would someday be discovered and traced back to its planet of origin, a derelict rock devoid of all atmosphere and life. John Rourke, his right gloved fist balled tightly to the pistol grip of his daughter's M16, his best friend beside him, continued moving through the heavy snowfall toward the mountain. Time might already have run out. Michael Rourke was the first through into the brilliant white light radiating from the base of the cylinder into which the air and watertight door opened. The cylinder itself extended down, seemingly without end. Here the light was gray, but by contrast to the pitch blackness through which they had moved, the blackness broken only by the beams of their flashlights, it was startlingly bright. Michael clicked off his German Engelhead light and pouched it to his belt.
Come ahead.
He stepped down onto the rungs of a ladder that reached down toward the light. Above him was the solid face of the cylinder's top. As he entered, he was initially fearful that the cylinder itself might be a missile launching tube, but with a sealed cap, it couldn't be. Maria stepped out, and he helped her onto the ladder rungs.
What is this?
An access tube. Maybe to the missile tubes. But the ladder points that way.
The tube seemed almost polished, and he wondered if it were closed at its base with another door similar to the one through which he and now Maria had just passed. This door had identical-seeming opening hardware on the interior, identical to the exterior, except for an almost total lack of tarnish. The air inside the tube smelled stale. When he had finally, with the help of the others, gotten the door open, there had been a popping sound, almost like the sound of a corked bottle of wine being opened in one of his father's videotaped movies at the retreat. The group moved down along the ladder, Maria immediately above Michael, followed by Prokopyev and finally Han Lu Chen. They were still roped together, and Michael opted to maintain the arrangement. The rungs seemed sturdy enough, but he refused to assume that the next one he stepped on would not give way. He thought of his father's often heard words, "It pays to plan ahead."
This is apparently an access tube. We'll follow it down until it plays out or branches off. If that Chinese agent got out this way, we should be able to get in. Han, close the door behind us and lock it.
Yes.
Han swung the latch closed behind them. The hatch closed with the sound of a self-sealing mechanism. Michael wondered fleetingly if the stagnant air supply would be enough to get them to their destination with the hatchway closed. But with it open, they stood a greater risk of detection should the shelf on which they found the door be part of some regular guard route.
Sound, even the sound of my voice, could travel a great distance in an environment such as this. So we have to keep sound to a minimum once we've started because we don't know what's below us. Ready?
There were nods of assent. Michael started down. Suddenly there was motion all around her. There was gunfire, and Sarah Rourke threw the muzzle of her STG-101 toward what she perceived as the enemy and prayed she was right as her finger touched the trigger. A small diameter flash burst from the end of her gun. The sudden light made the self-compensating vision intensification goggles she wore blink, shutting down luminance as the brighter flashes burst all around her. It was like the old silent movies she saw in museums and on television, the motion broken, distorted, jerky. The STG-101 bucked in her hands. Figures in line with its muzzle went down.
Move ahead quickly, Frau Rourke. I am with you.
The robot video probes were zigzagging erratically as if suddenly they had lost all control. And when she looked back, it was the man who controlled them who was going down, dead. The monitor panels on the steady mount in front of him aflame, sparks crackling from them. She ran, almost tripping over one of the robot video probes as it came toward her left ankle like some angry little dog. A hand reached out for her, and she thought for an instant it was Wolfgang Mann or one of the others, but in his other hand was a Soviet assault rifle. She fired first, and the man's body rocked back out of the edge of her peripheral vision. There was no way to keep count of the number of rounds fired. The cyclic rate was so rapid. She fired again as a figure fired at her. The 40-round magazine was empty, or the gun was jammed. In the semi-darkness and the confusion, with people all around her trying to kill her, there was no time to find out. She worked the bolt for the underbarrel grenade launcher and actuated the self-contained triggering mechanism within the magazine itself, aiming at a concentration of the Russian kill squad blocking the tunnel. The STG-101 bucked in her fists. There was a brilliant flash. She found another magazine for the STG-101, released the spent or partially spent one, rammed the fresh one up the magazine well, tugged at the charging handle, and let the bolt fly forward. If the gun fired, it hadn't been a jam. It fired. Another of the Russians went down. Two more of them dodging clear of her.
Into the area past the explosion. Hurry! Then we use the grenade launchers. Hurry!
He wasn't talking just to her, she realized, running again, working the bolt for the grenade launcher, chambering a fresh round. She fell, almost touching the grenade launcher's trigger, legs and arms splayed out on the tunnel floor, something dead inches from her face, human once, but the left side of the face blown away.
Ugh.
She struggled to get back to her feet, her rifle still in her hands. Hands grabbed at her under the armpits. She tried to twist the muzzle of the rifle toward whoever it was.
Sarah, hurry!
It was Mann beside her, almost lifting her straight up, half carrying her ahead as she ran beside him, his hands at her elbows. They zigzagged to avoid a body, jumped over another. Sarah nearly lost her footing in the sudden slickness that she knew had to be blood. They were past the point at which they were attacked.
Prepare your grenade launcher!
Zellers was already ready to fire, and as the others formed around her and Colonel Mann and opened fire, she opened fire as well. She squinted against the bright flashes as the grenades exploded. The tunnel seemed to shake with the successive multiple impacts and stray gunfire from the enemy force for a moment. Then, nothing. She could smell burning flesh. It sickened her. Would have made her vomit if she hadn't smelled it before.
Reload!
Sarah was already doing that, having exhausted the magazine load of grenades.
The Russian prisoner died in the initial exchange, Herr Colonel. Poor bastard. Of the casualties, Schmidt. Three dead, including the remote video probe operator. And one wounded, but not so seriously. He can't go on. We must find those Chinese troops. We are severely outnumbered here. Hurry on!
Mann propelled her forward. Sarah kept her trigger finger outside the STG-101's guard, but kept the tumbler set to auto, ready.
I am getting confusing radio reports. There's so much radio traffic. Wait!
Annie listened to Otto Hammerschmidt's report as she brushed a strand of hair back from Natalia's face. Natalia's eyelids blinked rapidly as though she were dreaming. The drug-induced sleep seemed deep for a time, but now Natalia seemed more restless by the moment.
The first city is partially under attack. The Soviet forces converged on the main entrance and several key sections within the city, including the government complex. Our base that was under construction was overrun and Colonel Mann has taken personal charge. Those communist assholes. Excuse me, but they're in for trouble now with the Colonel running things.
Natalia's eyelids flickered, only more rapidly now, dreaming. John's fingers touched the nape of her neck. He found the hooks and eyes that closed the halter there and opened it. As Natalia watched her own image in the full-length mirror, John Rourke behind her, the upper portion of her white dress fell away and her breasts were bare. She crossed her arms over her chest, covering herself with her hands, the nipples of her breasts hard and erect. His mouth came down on her neck and she shivered. John's tuxedo was gone. He turned her around in his arms and he was naked. Her dress fell from where it clung at her hips, falling in a sultry cascade to her ankles, hiding her feet. She, too, was naked. The hair of his chest felt wonderfully rough against her skin as she unfolded her arms, baring her breasts to him, and felt the first instant of contact between their bodies. Natalia started to cry as his lips touched her face. Annie Rourke Rubinstein studied Natalia's face, the eyelids moving more violently now, and to Annie's amazement, tears flowed from Natalia's eyes and along her cheeks. Annie closed her eyes, somehow feeling like a voyeur. John Rourke planned ahead. Thanks to a heat-sensing unit he stripped out of one of their specials, Rourke could see a ragged-looking group of Mongols in a depression near the base of the mountain guarding a tunnel entrance. They were slaughtering one of their wounded. He had scanned the base of the mountain using the sensor and determined the location of the tunnel from several hundred yards away. Then, with Paul Rubinstein beside him, he moved as close to the tunnel as possible for more detailed visual observation. It was then that he first saw the Mongols and found the actual entrance. Again, with Paul beside him, he worked his way closer. Now, 50 yards from the Mongol position, John Rourke brought the M16 to his shoulder, set to semi-only. Paul's rifle was set to auto and aimed toward the Mongol position to back him up if he missed. But John Rourke did not plan to miss. He counted six men, discounting the seventh man on the ground who was being repeatedly stabbed with the Mongols' sabers, kicked by their fur-ruffed booted feet and spat upon. Perhaps the man had shown cowardice, perhaps some other undesirable trait. It was equally possible the Mongols were just amusing themselves with someone who was dying anyway.
Here we go.
Rourke got the farthest of the six men in his sights, then gently squeezed the trigger. With the first one, there was always more time. The M16 jumped slightly. The farthest of the six standing Mongols fell. As Rourke swung the Colt assault rifle's muzzle onto his next target, he considered the moral imperative that the already dying seventh man imposed, that he be helped. Rourke fired again. The second man's arms and hands flew outward, his saber sailing through the snow-filled air as his body slapped back into the rocks. The third man was moving. Rourke fired. He stopped moving. The fourth man was shouldering his assault rifle.
John, he's...
I know.
The Mongol's rifle fell from his hands, his head twisting around, his body seeming to be dragged after it, falling. The fifth man was running toward the tunnel the heat-sensing device had picked up. John Rourke tickled the trigger once again, the fifth man's body skidding off balance, forward, the man's hands grasping toward the small of his back as he fell. The sixth man fired his assault rifle, missing them by a good 10 feet. John Rourke thumbed the selector to auto.
Help me out.
As Rourke fired, Rubenstein fired. The sixth man's body, racked with hits, twisted, lurched, and slammed into the rocks behind him, his assault rifle still spraying, but skyward now, his right arm twisting with the torque, the gun finally falling as it fired out empty. John Rourke and Paul Rubenstein half dove into a snowbank. Although the sounds of the battle between the Soviet attackers and the Second City Chinese defenders were everywhere, the remote possibility existed that sounds of this brief battle might somehow be detected and bring more of the Chinese, or worse still, KGB Elite Corps commandos. Rourke looked right and left through the swirling snow. He squinted against the huge flakes. No one was coming. He signaled to Paul to break left as he broke right. Rourke rammed a fresh magazine up the M16's well as he and Paul closed on the concealed mouth of the tunnel in a pincer formation. Rourke's right hand was numbing with the cold. He hadn't trusted to a glove, and there was no time to replace it now that it was off. They reached the Mongol position almost simultaneously. Rourke stepped over one of the dead bodies to aid the seventh man, but the man's wide-eyed stare into the falling snow told the dead man's tale. Rourke exhaled over the eyes to melt the snow, then closed the lids. There was no need to tell Paul to cover him. The two friends methodically checked each of the other six.
Mine are all dead!
Mine too!
Rourke looked behind them toward the nearest battlefront, but no one came. He safed his rifle and let it fall to his side on its sling, then found his glove.
If I was starting a Glock pistol collection, I'd be in business. Same for the assault rifles. And the sabers look terrible, almost as terrible as the rifles. No documents.
I've got a Glock 17 at the retreat. Fine pistol. Really durable, too. As I suppose the very existence of these proves. Leave the bodies! No time anyway!
Rourke moved quickly through the trampled down snow to the concealed entrance his sensing device had shown was there. He worked his hand into the glove as he walked, opening and closing his hand to restore proper circulation. Finding the entrance proved no challenge. A stainless steel door of reasonably good finish was hidden half-heartedly at the rear of an out-of-place-looking stand of pines. Some boughs were broken where the tunnel had apparently been used recently.
Paul! Bring me the strongest saber you can find!
There was no reason to get his knife full of pine tar again. He turned, waiting for Paul to join him. As Paul ran up, Rourke took the saber from him, eyeballing it for an instant, then stepped slightly back from the stand of trees. With a few downward cuts, he hacked away a sufficient number of the pine boughs to clear access to the tunnel door beyond. He tossed the saber into a snowbank a few feet away. The door was, as expected, closed. A ring handle was in place on the far left of the door, equidistant between top and bottom. Rourke reached for it with his right hand, his rifle bunched tight in his left fist. Rourke moved the door slowly open, inward. There was a terrible, strong stench even as the snow-laden wind blew in. Dull yellow light glowed faintly in the distance. Between the meager light cast inward through the door and the yellow light beyond lay nothing but blackness. Rourke closed his right hand over the butt of one of the German Angle-head flashlights.
Watch out!
Rourke pushed the switch, shining the light into the darkness of the tunnel. As quickly as he flicked it on, he flicked it off.
What's the matter? What'd you see in there?
Rourke flicked the light on.
Human bones. Come on, close the door behind you. Mind you don't trip on a femur or something.
The men stepped through the doorway, Rourke shining the light about him on all sides as Paul pulled the door closed. Paul didn't instantly see a femur, but he saw human bones of all other descriptions. His left boot brushed against an anterior segment of a human skull. Human vertebrae crunched under his feet as he moved ahead.
My God!
No, I think it has something to do with their God.
Rourke moved into the darkness and heard something from deep within the silken dark ahead. Sarah Rourke's temples hurt from the sudden absence of the pressure associated with the vision intensification goggles. But here, in the light of a vast recreation hall beyond a kitchen in which they had taken cover as one of the Soviet murder squads passed, there was plenty of light. She pocketed her goggles in the BDU jacket and immediately set to checking her rifle, as the nine remaining commandos under Wolfgang Mann's command set to checking ways in and out. She satisfied herself as to the condition of her weapon, then realized she was terribly hungry. But there was nothing to eat, even though she stood in this vast dining hall. All the weight in her rucksack was ammunition. A solitary canteen of water hung on her belt. She didn't want to drink, because if she did, she might have to urinate, and where could she do that? Sarah Rourke shook her head, disgusted. Where were the Chinese?
Where are our Chinese friends?
I hope they brought Chinese food with them. I'm turning off my radio.
Sarah shut off the radio. In the hall, they were close enough that they could speak to one another naturally. Perhaps the radio chatter was giving her the headache. There were two other sets of doors in addition to the kitchen doors through which they entered. A pair of Colonel Mann's commandos flanked these doors now, ready to open them. One man from each team placed a suction device several inches in diameter against the doors. The black rubber piece functioned like the bell of a stethoscope to detect what might lie beyond the doors. There was considerable risk that the Chinese unit they were to meet encountered one of the roving Soviet patrols and had been killed, captured, or even just delayed. That would mean scrubbing the mission or penetrating the government center themselves without reinforcements. In that case, Mann's group would be attempting to rescue the chairman of the first city on their own. Sarah heard fingers snapping, started to speak aloud as she turned toward the sound, then on impulse hit the button to reactivate her radio. She nodded toward Wolfgang Mann.
I'm receiving.
There is activity beyond the doors. This way.
Mann gestured for her to join him on the other side of the recreation hall. She moved quickly to him, mildly surprised she wasn't feeling greater fatigue as a result of the relatively sedentary lifestyle she adopted for her pregnancy. She stopped beside Mann. He raised a finger to his lips, signaling silence. She scanned the room. Colorful murals covered the upper portions of the walls, their theme apparently Chinese folklore. There were dragons, princesses, scraggly bearded men in flowing robes who looked like some cross between monk and wizard.
Schmidt, come in. Schmidt?
There was no answer from the tall, Nordic-looking Sergeant Schmidt. Colonel Mann left him to guard the doors leading from the kitchen to the corridors just fronting the end of the tunnel from which they'd come.
Schmidt!
Still no answer. Mann's face was seamed with worry.
Quickly, into the hallway. Standard entry pattern. On my mark!
The remaining men of Wolfgang Mann's command moved out as if they were pre-programmed automatons. One man on each side of the doorways, the others in an arc just behind them, weapons ready in their well-trained movement. Mann joined the team on the left. Sarah stopped beside him until he pushed her behind him.
Close your coat. It has bullet-resistant properties. Or did I mention that?
Awkwardly, with his left hand, he withdrew the antique Walther P-38 he carried, the STG-101 in his right hand.
No.
Close it, then.
He turned his head toward the men at the other doors.
Be ready. Now!
For the first time, she realized the stethoscope-like listening devices had been removed, and, where the doors seemed, there was a small black rectangular object. She guessed an explosive charge. In the well-lighted corridor beyond, she saw a dozen Soviet elite corps commandos in their black BDUs, assault rifles at the ready, wheeling toward the explosions. But Mann's people fired first. There was gunfire from behind them, and Sarah automatically turned toward it. More of the Soviet commandos pouring into the recreation hall through the kitchen doors. She hit the bolt to cycle one of the grenades into the assault rifle's launcher, then pulled the trigger. As the first grenade exploded, she was already launching a second, Mann beside her, spraying one of the 40-round magazines empty, the P-38 9mm firing from his left hand. Sarah Rourke kept firing the grenade launcher. The Russians coming through the kitchen doors fell back. Mann tapped her arm with the muzzle of his pistol, the slide locked back, the gun empty.
Sarah, come with me!
They ran toward the blown-open doors. Michael's group reached a landing, and at the end of the landing, a long, high-ceiling tunnel ran perpendicular to the tube. It looked like a possible way into the second city, perhaps through the missile launching station itself. The tube they had worked their way down seemed to go on forever.
Any unauthorized access beyond this point will activate the defense system. Unauthorized persons should turn back immediately. Warning, dangerous. Turn back.
They're certainly explicit enough.
Given my wounds, I am the logical person to go first.
That's a great and noble thought, Vasily. but you're also less capable of running away from whatever gets started, and we need you alive if we bump into any of your troops.
Prokopyev's broad shoulders shrugged under his torn Soviet uniform.
I can...
Michael looked at Maria Leuden.
No, I won't let you. You have the best chance of making enough sense out of their computer that we can enable an abort program.
Michael looked at Han.
And don't you start. I've gone first since we started down the chimney, and there's no reason to change that now.
Michael began loosening the knot holding the rope about his waist.
This may be bullshit.
Michael nodded toward the wall.
Or the defense system hasn't survived the centuries. Or maybe it still works. I'm going to put a lot more distance between us, and we're changing the order here. Han, you rope in behind me, but keep about 25 or 30 feet back. We've got rope to spare. Then Maria, you and Prokopyev rope onto Han. If they have electronic traps, they might have trap doors, anything. This way, if the floor goes out from under me, I'm covered, but nobody's so close that if it's something else, they'll be hurt. The important thing is that Maria's computer knowledge and Han's knowledge of Chinese come together at the fire control center for the Chinese missiles. If they really are planning on detonating, that's the only chance we have to stop them.
Michael looked at Vasily Prokopyev and shot the KGB Elite Corps commander a smile.
And guess what that makes us, Vasily?
The word, it escapes me, but I understand.
Michael looked at him a moment longer.
The words, expendable.
If we use guns, we'll attract whatever's human anywhere within a quarter of a mile inside. If the gunfire outside hasn't attracted them already.
I understand. But I'm more worried about what isn't human.
John Rourke let the M16 fall to his side on its sling. His right hand closed over the haft of the life support 10, and he unsheathed it. He heard Paul pull his Gerber MK2 fighting knife. They began walking again. From the darkness outside the cones of their flashlight beams, Rourke heard footfalls and breathing so heavy it sounded labored. He wheeled toward the sounds.
Watch out from the left!
As Rourke swung the light, something out of a nightmare materialized less than a yard from him. It was a bear, but the creature was horribly disfigured. One eye burned away. The bear's right front paw slapped toward him, and Rourke dodged back. The bear came at him again.
Holy shit! Watch out!
The bear turned awkwardly toward Paul Rubenstein. Rourke held the LS-10 in his right fist as if it were a rapier. He lunged and thrust the blade into the bear from behind, aiming for what in a human would have been the branches of the external carotid. But he felt the primary edge of his knife slip against muscle. The bear spun toward him. Rourke backstepped just in time. He aimed the light toward the animal's remaining eye. Rourke could see Paul in silhouette to the bear's right side. Paul stabbed down, burying his knife in the bear halfway to the hilt. The animal twisted, its face contorted in a rictus of agony, and slapped its right forepaw into Paul's chest. Rubenstein slammed against the tunnel wall and slid down as his flashlight tumbled away. Rourke's knife flashed forward again, the flashlight in his left hand still aimed toward the bear's solitary eye. The LS-10 stabbed into the bear's throat. The hulking body twisted. Rourke, still holding the knife, got wrenched from his feet. The bear turned to fall on him. Rourke ripped at the knife, pulling it free, rolling right as the animal crashed down, paws clawing at the tunnel floor and the wildly gyrating beam of the angle head as it fell from Rourke's grasp. Rourke threw himself onto the animal now, the LS-10 in both fists, hammering down into the neck and head and shoulders, stabbing again and again, the animal's body heaving under him, the cries emanating from the creature at once frightening and pitiful. The body seemed to convulse, and as the head turned right, Rourke drove the knife half the length of its foot-long blade into the side of the neck. All movement ceased. Rourke let go of the knife and fell back from the animal to the tunnel floor.
John? John!
I'm all right. How about you?
Whew. It knocked the wind out of me. Holy...
Yeah.
Rourke picked up the flashlight, shone the light toward the sound of Paul's voice. His friend was getting shakily to his feet.
Your light's over there.
He pointed his light to a spot a few yards distant.
I see it.
Rourke shone the light on the dead bear. There could be more creatures like this confined in the tunnel, but somehow he didn't think so. Paul's knife was still buried in the animal. Rourke braced his left foot against the dead animal and wrenched the blade free. He set the blade on the floor, just out of the growing blood pool. His own knife had bitten deeper and was harder to extract, but he got it free.
Should have tried grinning him to death like Davy Crockett did.
Yeah, well, you try that technique next time and let me know how it turns out. I'll loan you my knife just in case the bear's nearsighted.
bears usually were. It was one of the reasons why, in the wild at least, bears might attack when unprovoked, mistaking a human for another like itself.
You bet. You lend me your nose plugs, too. That thing stinks to high heaven. Whew.
With a flashlight, Rourke scanned the creature's body. Burn marks and other less immediate signs of mutilation were everywhere on the back, paws, and head. Clearly deliberate torture.
Why'd they do that to him?
They bred him to be a man-eater, then kept him set up with a constant supply. Deliberately caused him as much pain as possible, kept him enraged. My guess is, he's the source of all our bones down here. Or maybe he had a predecessor who contributed some of them.
That's why they kept their zoo. To use the animals.
Shit. The bastards.
Yeah, it looks like that. You up to moving on?
Rourke wiped the blades of both knives as clean as possible against the hide of the animal.
Poor creature. What kind of people? Damn them! This animal, the people they put in here for him to kill, what kind of people are they?
The kind of people we've come to stop from detonating a nuclear warhead. The bear was their watchman and executioner at the same time. Come on.
Rourke sheathed his knife and strode deeper into the tunnel. At any moment, a warhead might be triggered, and Rourke realized he would never know it because he would be instantly vaporized, just gone. The angle of the tunnel floor began to rise sharply, steadily. As they continued deeper into the tunnel, the yellow light Rourke first noticed from the doorway grew brighter. They kept moving. No more strange breathing noises, no growls from the shadows. But what lay ahead, Rourke realized, might be far worse than a mutilated animal exploited to kill. According to his Rolex, almost an hour had passed since they entered the tunnel. How much of that time consumed by the fight with the bear was impossible to say. It could have been seconds or several minutes. Over their years together, Rourke learned violence tended to dilate and distort one's perception of time. The more intense the violence, the greater the distortion. The bones were fewer here and considerably less concentrated than farther back, and this caused John Rourke to consider that something near the end of the tunnel might have kept the bear away. What? Rourke wondered. They kept moving.
What do we try to do exactly once we get to where we're going?
If they have a detonation program begun, we try to stop it. If we can't stop it, then we try to think of something to neutralize or at least minimize the effect.
You mean, if it's a missile, we keep it from launching and let it detonate inside the mountain? What about the other warheads, though?
Well, how do you like your goose cooked? If it gets to that, there won't be that many options left.
What about Michael and the others?
There's a chance they'll get the job done and this will be unnecessary. But as long as there's a chance they won't, buddy, they got about the same chance we have. Not very good.
Rourke felt a smile cross his lips as he clapped Paul on the shoulder.
But, old friend, when's that ever stopped us, huh?
Only idiots or people with a death wish pursued hopeless danger, or people with no other options remaining. Such had been the relationship between Rourke and Paul Rubenstein. No other options. Rourke thought back to the times between the night of the war and the great conflagration. Then or now, he could have asked for no finer friend, known no braver, no finer man. The tunnel floor rose so steeply now that it was like walking up a hillside. The added effort imposed by the incline slowed them. After another 10 minutes, as reckoned by Rourke's mental clock, the incline leveled suddenly. The yellow light shone brilliant and dead ahead of them. Something inside John Rourke made his pulse race, his breathing faster. He knew the sensation well, fear, but he didn't know its cause, and that worried him more. Michael Rourke stepped warily into the access tunnel. He searched from side to side for some evidence of security measures. Nothing. No out-of-place-looking seams in the floor, no photoelectric eyes, no speaker panels that shouldn't be where they were. The well-lit, gleaming walls of the tunnel were without feature, perfectly smooth and unbroken. He stopped moving, carefully turned and looked behind him. Han stood 30 feet back, Maria and Vasily Prokopyev behind Han. He turned back and looked down the tunnel that seemed to go on forever. For a moment, Michael Rourke wondered if he should turn back, return to the vertical cylinder that led down from the shelf off the natural rock chimney at the height of the mountain. But where would that route take them?
Michael!
Michael reached out to the wall. Michael. It vibrated in rhythm with Maria's echoing and re-echoing voice. Michael. He looked back toward Maria. Her hands were to her ears, her mouth wide open. If she screamed, if he shouted to her not to scream, Han turned toward her, the muzzle of his rifle clanged against the wall. Michael Rourke's ears throbbed with a cacophony of sound. He reached to his waist, slipped the hitch that bound the rope around him, threw the rope down, and ran. He saw Prokopyev's face contorting into a ghastly-looking mask. The Russian officer fell to his knees. Han Lu-Chen beat his fists against the wall. The walls pulsed along the length of the tunnel like the tines of a struck tuning fork. Maria was about to scream. Michael Rourke dashed past Han Lu-Chen, half-stumbled over the agonized Prokopyev. He threw himself on Maria Lloyden, his left hand clamping over her mouth, his right hand smothering her face against his chest. Moisture dribbled down the sides of his neck, and he realized his eardrums were probably bleeding, ruptured. Blood poured from Maria's ears. Han Lu-Chen's body flopped against the wall, his knees buckling, his body collapsing. Michael watched Vasily Prokopyev's right hand. Prokopyev pointed a pistol down the tunnel's length as blood poured from his ears and nose, his eyes wide. Mongols with heavy ear protection were running up the tunnel. Michael saw Prokopyev plugged to the floor of the passageway. Michael's inside shook, and Maria's body wrenched against his. Michael's brain felt as if it were boiling over. The walls and floor and ceiling shook. Michael's hearing nearly gone, his vision blurring, the pain beyond anything he'd ever endured. He embraced a blackness sweet as a kiss. John Rourke stopped before the yellow light. It shone from behind a wall several inches thick and totally transparent. The transparent material was jointed every 12 feet by gleaming vertical metal strips, framed at top and bottom with identical strips. The verticals rose hundreds of feet into the air, and beyond the wall lay an area the size of several football fields. Its ceiling vaulted to the height of the mountain itself, it seemed. It was all here under one roof, rank upon rank of auxiliary service bunkers connected by gleaming pipe systems to more than a dozen breadloaf-shaped concrete structures. Piping ran into and out of demineralizers, turbines, condensate pumps, feedwater pumps. Beyond these, running the length of the base of the mountain, disappearing over the internal horizon, he saw transformers and storage tanks. Tall, tapered waste concrete smokestacks stood in the mist-shrouded distance. It was the largest fission reactor John Rourke had ever seen.
This is how they run the mountain.
This is why they've had power for 5 centuries. And it's a miracle they did. It has to be totally automated.
They saw panels of gauges stretching for hundreds of yards in either direction, untended for centuries. No one here possessed the technological sophistication to read the panels. Rourke began walking, his hand trailing along the plexiglass. He scanned the banks of consoles. After some minutes of walking in silence, he stopped. The Chinese of the Second City could not have comprehended what was here, judging from the barbarism they displayed. And John Rourke, for that matter, understood little of it. But no degree of sophistication was needed to understand the panel farthest rearward from them. The panel was larger than all the rest and resembled a thermometer lying on its side. It held a large, horizontally running gauge, the indicator for core temperature. The gauge was a third of the way into the red zone.
They're about to lose it all. It's melting down, Paul.
Melting down?
Rourke studied the machinery for several seconds, wishing Natalia were here with her superior knowledge of such things, her engineering and sabotage background an invaluable mix.
I just had a wild idea.
What?
If this is melting down, why isn't there an alarm sounding? Now this is nuts. You can't tell me that the Second City are just about to detonate a warhead, if that's what they're planning, and the reactor that served them all these years just happens to go belly up?
I don't understand what you mean, but shouldn't we get the hell out of here?
Well, if it's leaking, we're already contaminated, so there's no sense running. I mean, think about it. This was a survival retreat like ours in Georgia, but on a ridiculously larger scale. The reactor was going to keep it going. Air scrubbers, electricity, water reprocessing, all of it. So between the night of the war and what the Chinese call the Dragon Win, the Chinese here put their hands on a substantial portion of the People's Republic's nuclear warheads. Whoever was in charge here would only have done that for one reason, power, and not just light bulbs. But when the Dragon Win came, they realized that the core materials wouldn't last as long as they'd need them to last. Missiles were only useful for destruction, and destruction was already total. So,
you mean
we're looking at the Chinese warheads, Paul. This huge reactor, the biggest I've ever seen, vastly bigger than anyone would ever need for any conventional use you can imagine. You could run 50 places this size, maybe 100 off one-tenth the power this reactor could generate. And it's computerized, it has to be. The computer is using the nuclear material as needed, otherwise keeping the fissionable material rotted. At the same time, it's a breeder reactor, producing more fissionable material than it uses. This entire mountain is a weapon. Whoever built this was perfectly aware of that. No warheads, just one ultimate weapon. If this thing goes, the meltdown effect would be incalculable.
I remember the near misses before the night of the war. The almost meltdowns. They talked about the core material boring its way through the Earth from one end to the other, didn't they? Sounded like something out of a bad science fiction movie. Like the story they tell children that if you dig and you dig and you dig a hole all the way to China. Well, how about a Chinese kid digs a hole, and it's a mile wide, and his shovel digs all by itself and very fast, so fast you can't stop it. And the other end of the hole is the Atlantic Ocean off the southern coast of Brazil.
Yeah, that'd,
It'd throw the Earth's rotation off. Maybe rip the planet in half. Yeah, I'm no physicist.
But how do we... They must have kicked a program into the computer and started all this. Maybe it can't be stopped by conventional means.
Could we go inside? I mean, I know what had happened to us, but...
There must be 50 rods in each reactor core. The control rods themselves could have begun to melt. I mean, yeah, we could go inside, but I don't think we'd live long enough to get the job half done. Once we violate the seal on one of the containment buildings, the entire area will be flooded with radiation. Even with protective clothing, we wouldn't be able to hold out for more than a few hours. But we might have to go inside if that's the only way.
John Rourke looked at his friend.
Let's find their temple.
Rourke stepped away from the plexiglass wall. As his arm passed near one of the vertical joints for the enormous plexiglass panels, he felt an odd pressure against the exposed skin between his glove and his sleeve. It felt like a breath of wind where there shouldn't be wind at all. Suddenly, he understood about the bear and why there were fewer bones the closer to the plexiglass wall one came.
Paul, run for it!
The wind was all around him now, and electricity arced between his rifle and the right side of his body. His body felt as if it were at once burned and stabbed, and pain tore through him. Rourke stumbled as he tried to run, and fell before blue and silver lines of electrical energy fluxing across the horizontal supporting the plexiglass panels from below. Rourke turned around to see Paul's body twitching, the muzzle of his M16 against one of the verticals, electricity arcing over Paul's chest and around his legs like bands. Rourke fell flat, rolled onto his back, pain gripping his chest. Electricity continued to arc between his rifle and the nearest of the verticals. Rourke's gloved right hand grasped his rifle by the plastic buttstock, and he tore it, sling and all, from his body, flinging it against the wall of plexiglass. The crackle of electricity grew, the plexiglass itself starting to blister. He couldn't catch his breath. His mouth hung wide open, gulping air. He forced himself onto his stomach. His eyes felt as though they would burst from his head, yet remained riveted on Paul Rubinstein. Paul was dying, would die.
No! Damn it!
Rourke lurched up to his knees, fell forward. Paul was nearly cocooned by electricity. As Rourke reached his feet, the rounds in Rourke's M16 began cooking off. Bullets sprayed in all directions as the controlless assault rifle bounced along the floor as the last round exploded.
Paul!
Through his pain, Rourke reached to his right hip, his right arm stiff, barely able to move. Somehow, he pulled the 629 out of the Sparks flat holster. Rourke stabbed the 6-inch 44 Magnum Smith toward the vertical to which the flash deflector of Paul's assault rifle was melting. In a moment, Paul's rifle would cook off as well. The shot rebounded off the sheet. Rourke's right hand trembled. His ears rang with the concussion. The second shot ripped half through the metal vertical. The reactor compartment's integrity was ruptured. The vertical metal strip severed. The electrical arcs across Paul's body dissipated for an instant. Rourke let the revolver spill from his fingers as he pushed himself up. He hurtled his body against his friend. Residual electrical charge ripped through Rourke's body as his left shoulder impacted Paul's right shoulder. Rourke grabbed Paul by the clothing, threw his weight away from the severed vertical, and both men tumbled to the floor. He forced himself up enough to see Paul, who wasn't breathing. Rourke straightened Paul's upper body as best he could, raising the neck, letting the head loll back, forcing open the mouth. Rourke sucked in as much air as his own tortured body would allow, the heel of Rourke's left hand holding the forehead back. Rourke's first finger and thumb pinched the nostrils shut. Rourke blew short breaths, four of them, into Paul's bluing mouth. Rourke released Paul's head, and with the heels of both hands, he hammered down against the lower half of the sternum 15 times. His arms were so weary he could barely move them. Then, a pulse. The eyelids fluttered.
Jesus.
John Rourke collapsed to the floor beside his friend. The roaring awakened him. Michael Rourke opened his eyes. He was cold. There were faces looking down on him, Chinese faces. The lips moved, but he could hear nothing except the drone. He moved his head, and spasms of pain fired through his head, his neck, and his limbs. He was naked. One face stared down at him. It was the woman who liked to see men die. The woman he'd met 2 days ago in the dungeon while the Russian sergeant was being slaughtered. She was laughing at him.